You're listening to the Home Staging Show podcast, and this is Season 2, Episode 10. This is your host, Cindy Lin. Hey guys, welcome back. It's really great to have you on the show today, and I feel very, very special because I'm recording today's intro from Palm Springs while being on an astrology retreat led by Astral Twins. The people who are responsible for the horoscopes at L.com and Refinery29. There are also two incredible twin sisters and astrologers and amazing human beings I feel very lucky to call friends. In my life, I'm really more of a dabbler when it comes to astrology, but it's always nice to be going on a retreat. I'm a bit of a retreat junkie. In case you haven't noticed, since I just wrapped the one for stagers last week in Napa. And I'm also in town just to do some location scouting for a potential new retreat for next year. So I feel very incredibly blessed to be lucky enough to be able to come and just hang out with friends and learn a little bit more about astrology. So I usually publish my episodes on Wednesday mornings on our blog. So if you're listening to this on a Wednesday, on November 11th, when this episode is published, it is also Veterans Day and November 11th. So 11-11 is a very auspicious number in numerology and astrology. I know discussing 11-11 may sound a little bit out there, like I'm a California hippie girl, but I also believe in the power of intention. So whether it is staging your home for sale, you really want to set that intention and have that mindset. You know, I feel like in business and life, a lot of times it is about mindset. It's about what you put your head, what your intention is for. So it's really important whether you believe in 11-11 or not. If you're working on selling your home or any other project in your life, go ahead, set that intention for yourself and make a wish. Everyone can make a wish, right? So I really want that for you because I think the power of mindset is incredibly important. So whether you believe it or not, just check it out. There's no harm done. I actually asked a numerologist, Felicia Bender, about the meaning behind 11-11. She explained that the day is it's the number and the day is a manifestation portal. So every universal life force that you believe in gives you an opportunity to ask you to clean up the thoughts and manifest your thought on that day. Because whatever you believe in, it is going to magnify that energy. It's like the law of attraction in action. So it's actually a very powerful day. So whatever you're thinking about today, when you apply that action, you can really magnify the results. Another suggestion is that to be specific about what you want abundance in life for. You really have to move the needle. So stop obsessing about all the negative energy, like a terrible friend, and calling on the one that you really want. So Felicia has a blog on this particular subject, and I'll link that in the show notes today. And if you're interested in about the Tulum retreat in Mexico, the dates next year is April 2nd through April 8th. If you're interested in joining the twins, you can go to their website at astrostyle.com/events. And I'll put that in the show notes as well. The Astral Twins also has an article on 11-11, so I'll link that in the show notes as well if you're interested. So anyway, let's talk about today's actual show. On today's show, we're interviewing interior designer and blogger Carla Aston. I first came across her work when I was researching for a blog post, and I came across her blog. I just really love her approach on design, and I think it's a really practical way, and it's still very beautiful with her end results. And I really love that she really makes it work for her clients. I also love her work. She has a really great way to pull rooms together and make them both functional and beautiful. On today's show, we're actually going to discuss interior design, styling, remodeling, finishes selections, color selections, and many other tricks and tools that make great looking and functional rooms. So I think it's going to be a really great show for you. And if you have been listening to the show for a while and like the show, please take a minute to rate and review the Home Staging Show on iTunes. That'll be super helpful because that will help others to find the show and allow me to keep recording and find great guests. Today's show is brought to you by EcoJoe, the eco-friendly St. Joseph statue home selling kit. In real estate, there's a tradition of praying to St. Joseph for good luck, and we made an eco-friendly statue made with clay. EcoJo is 100% natural. He won't harm the earth. To find out more about the product, please visit ecojokits.com. ecojokits.com. So without further ado, let's start the show today.
Thank you for having me. I love podcasts and I listen to them often, and I've enjoyed listening to yours too.
Oh, really? Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So I love your interior design work. Do you want to start by talking about how did you get started?
Yes. I started way back when I was in high school. I did some interior design projects in my home economic classes that I had in school. And we were all required to enter a contest where we did sample boards and designed a room. And ended up getting a went to that, and then we went on to design in a local furniture store, and I won that competition, and that sort of helped me fall in love with interior design. And from there, I went on to major in interior design in college.
That sounds amazing. So what did you do in your competition?
I think I did I had a room in my own house, because we were supposed to do a floor plan layout and then select furniture and all that. I did a living room. And then when I went to the furniture store, we ended up, you know, doing a vignette of a living room in a space there in the store.
That sounds cool. And I really, like, when I went on your website, I just really love your work. They're very elegant. The rooms are very elegant, relaxed, and they're very approachable. I also love the way you do your color schemes. So I was wondering, what is your design process?
Well, we start with the client's requests, and we always try to get a handle on sort of what the client expects as their end result and why are they coming to us. So we ask for them to send us photographs and pictures of what they see as what they would like to see as sort of their end result. We go to Pinterest, we use house.com and things like that for sourcing those kind of images. We ask them if they will send us links to their Pinterest boards, things like that. And then that helps us kind of establish a style. So once we have an end goal sort of in mind, then we start with pulling together a design plan for the project. So the first phase is sort of getting to know the client and what they want, what the end goal is, identifying the end goal. And then next we start with schematic design. After we do sort of an initial first blush presentation with the client, and that is sort of an overall view of what the project will look like with samples, drawings, things like that, that we have to show them. Then we get their feedback, and then we go into design development, which is more fine-tuning the process. It's more looking at each item and making sure the client is comfortable with each selection. We reselect some things at that time to kind of get them exactly where they want to be. And then from there, we start the documentation process, which is doing CAD drawings or finish schedules, anything that needs to be done to sort of document the project. We also work on doing furniture proposals at that time if we have a furniture job, and that helps get everything down in writing exactly what we want. And then from there, it's implementation, and it's all about sort of keeping tabs on the progress of the job with a contractor or with ordering items for furniture, that kind of thing.
That sounds very cool. And so do you do a mood board as well for your clients or for your own project, for your own purpose?
Yes, we usually do them for the clients. We do that after the schematic design usually. I have a studio here and we have a big conference table. And when we present to clients, we lay everything out on the conference table. And we don't put it in a digital version at that point because it might be massaged a little bit. Mm-hmm. And but basically we take that presentation and then we put it into mood boards and send that to a client as sort of a record of that presentation.
That's very cool. And do you have any rules when it comes to design?
Well, I like to keep things really simple. And you know, simple design can be very complicated, but I like the look to be simple, because a lot of times when people start living in their spaces, things just accumulate and new objects come in all the time. So there always needs to be a little bit of breathing room, I feel, in any end result that we're going for, because life is going to happen. And I just don't like it to be just so full and so so complex that there's no room for anything to come in at the end, you know?
Yeah. No, I love what you say about that too. I personally too love simple, because I think actually simple is very hard to achieve, because I think there is definitely a more of an editing process, and it sounds like that's what you help your client do as well. Especially for interior design, I think is even trickier than staging, because I think staging in a way, it's kind of like a dictatorship.
Yeah.
I come in and be like, this needs to go because buyers will not care for this. But for interior design, it's a very different approach, because someone is going to be living with that for a very long time. So,
right.
So yeah, so I definitely admired what you guys do on a day in and day out, because I think staging is, in a way, it is more simplified process, because you don't have to go back and forth with a client about their preference, because we're really doing it for the buyers.
That's right. And that can be quite a long process. And it's also, it's very personal, you know, and many times, you know, it's a little bit of a battle of wills, so to speak, but we're there to sort of make them happy and figure out what they want and try to implement their vision as well with some of our creativity and the way that we can help put things together. So we always try to keep their ideas in mind and try to make them number one. And it's kind of a different approach. It's really more personal and more custom.
Yeah. You know? And then do you also take their future lifestyle into consideration? Because I know, especially because I took some contingent classes, and they really talk about, like, you know, like especially as the population going to age. So a lot of design become more kind of like, I guess, senior friendly, in a sense where, like, the client, once they age, they can grow into this other phase of their life. Is that something that you do as well when you work with clients?
Yes. I have done a couple of bathrooms for people who are aging in place and for people who have disabilities. So we're very aware of, you know, needs that can come down the road. I've also done a CAPS training, which is aging in place. Mm-hmm. So, you know, zero entry shower, that kind of thing, and a wider door openings. All those things are really important to have in place. And they're not necessarily unsightly or things that, you know, get in the way of everyday life now. So they're nice to sort of put into a job that will be there when people need them, even if they don't need them at that time.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of that, because I do feel like a lot of times design decision does have to make it, like, in a way humanized. I don't know if that's a really good word for it, but you really have to grow with it. That's why I feel like I, you know, there's that debate between PC and Apple, right? But I one of the reason why I'm really a big fan of Apple products is I feel like it's very intuitive to use. You know, a 3-year-old can pick up an iPad and just start using it right away. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big fan of that, where design really serves functions, not only for aesthetics reason, making people feel good. It also has very practical use as well.
Right. And yes, so, I agree.
How do you go about pulling a room together?
Well, I have made a big investment here in my studio, and I have great selections here at my fingertips. It makes it very efficient to start pulling things together. For example, if I start on a bathroom, we have a whole section of our studio that's tile and stone samples and all the different kinds of products that we pull from. So we go back there and start pulling things, you know, with ideas in mind. But that combination process of pulling this one is so easy when everything's right there at your fingertips.
It sounds amazing. Your studio sounds amazing.
Well, it's like a candy store.
It sounds like it. I was like, I want to go and just see.
Yeah, we have for fabrics, we have these great bins that are all up and down our studio cabinetry, and they're all categorized by color. So we have a nice plastic bin that says the gray, fabric samples. They're all in there, and they're all favorites of ours. So we've gone through and culled through and basically gotten memo samples of all our favorite gray fabrics and put them in there. So when we are looking for gray fabrics, we go straight there, and we know that we love everything in there, and it's just a matter of finding just the right one then. So it's much easier to, pull for different projects and just to make things much more efficient.
Yeah, I think that's a really great idea. Because then I also feel like you are really injecting your design sense into the items that you pick. I feel like sometimes when people approach design, they just let clients see everything, and it's very overwhelming for clients. Because I think when clients come to you, for people like for design professionals, they really want to lean on your expertise. So right. I think that's a really clever process for sure.
Yeah, I think that to get the most value, I mean, people pay a lot of money for designers, and to get the most value of a designer, you really need to sort of realize that the designer is there to tap into their creativity and to tap into their way of extrapolating what you want and putting it into, a tangible room. So it's not where, if someone comes in and wants to just say, I want this, I want that, then they're really becoming the designer. And that's not really the best use of that designer's time and the money that you're paying for that designer.
Yeah, so I agree. I definitely agree with that. And then I know we exchanged notes before the show, and I love that you say that like your process of pulling the room together is a lot like cooking up a recipe. So do you want to talk a little bit more about that as well?
Sure. I feel like we, when we start pulling things together, we're always looking at how things bounce off each other. So for example, if we're working on a kitchen and we're looking at a granite countertop and then cabinet finish, everything, it's sort of, you really start assembling that, all those items together. And so once you start assembling them, it makes this unique mix for this particular client. So you may use the same product in one job that you do on another, but because it's combined with different things, it's going to be a totally different outcome. And that's kind of like a recipe and, cooking in the kitchen. And when you throw something else in, it becomes a different taste and a different flavor. So that's kind of what I meant by that.
Okay, that sounds great. And then you also mentioned that you start usually with the one thing that will make the biggest impact in the space. I find that idea very intriguing. Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Sure. I feel like sort of typically the architecture dictates a lot of what is sort of the major impact in the room, what should be the major impact in the room.
I agree.
So, for example, I'm working on my own kitchen right now. We just remodeled it, and I kind of came to a point where I really wanted to do a fabulous floor in my kitchen. And I thought I really maybe wanted to do some concrete tiles that had a big pattern or something. But really, when I took a step back and examined it like a designer instead of someone that just wants something, a regular, just wanted some wow. I realized that would really be kind of a waste of my money, because no one is going to see that floor in my house until you get in the kitchen, because it's sort of separated. Mm-hmm. So really where I needed to make my biggest impact and where my money would have been best spent was on a wall that is seen from all over the house. Mm. So what I did is I did a more subtle flooring in there, and then ended up putting the wow on the wall that's more visible. So architecture sort of dictates where you should spend your money and where you should be putting your big impact pieces.
I love that, actually, because I think when it comes to selling and staging, we say the same similar thing, where you really want to wow people on the first impression. So by focusing where you can really maximize the wow factor is actually very important. And I think it's actually often overlooked, because I think when most homeowners, they go about putting their room together, they really think about the comfort first, right? Like, where am I going to put my TV? Usually is the first question.
Yes.
Instead of like, right. What would make the room make sense, or even like traffic flow, like how the room is going to relate to the room next to it. I think that's something that people don't realize. Right. That's one of the big factor in making a very beautiful and comfortable home that is still very accessible, you know, so.
Right.
I think that's a great point.
And help it flow better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think flow
and
is
also
really
it's
a big
like,
thing.
Where do you put your dollars too? You know, I mean, if you want to put your dollars where they're going to matter. You know, for another thing is like in kitchens, I see a lot of people spend huge amounts of money on countertops, you know, and it may be that the wall element is more important, or vice versa. You know, it just kind of depends on how the architecture works and how you approach the space and where is the most noticeable elevation or wall or element, what will be the most noticeable thing in the room.
Okay.
And that's where you need to spend the money and put the wow.
I love we're talking about this already, because I definitely want to ask you about remodeling, because that's not something I do. I always joke that staging is a bit like Botox. And mm-hmm. when it comes to modeling, it's like a nose job. So I don't really do nose jobs for home. So yeah, I love that we're talking about remodeling already. And I also love you brought up countertop. Is that something that's something I'm always asked when the client's flipping the house. Do you have a preference in countertop that I use all the time? And some you might avoid because they might look pretty. Because I know like marble, for example, it's a big, people are like, oh, it looks really beautiful, but it's really hard to maintain. So a lot of times people don't even use them.
Right. Well, we're running into that a lot. Everybody likes white marble and wants it.
No, I want it.
Well, we have a good alternative, which is quartzite, which is a natural material also, but it is quite a bit more expensive. It's like mm-hmm. a very deluxe product. But a lot of people are opting for that just because they're so intent on having the white marble look. But quartzite is denser than marble or granite, and so it does not absorb, but it has that real soft look, and it's white, you know, it can go with gray, it can, you know, it looks very current. And so a lot of our clients are opting for that, just to bite the bullet and do that expense, because they are just really anxious to have that look.
That's very cool. I also seen paper stone. Have you used that before?
Like the No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's interesting because they make countertop out of paper. It sounds very crazy, but when you touch it, it didn't, I mean, it's, you know, they reprocess it and recompress it to make it a very mm-hmm. hard countertop. So that's very cool. And so what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see when it comes to remodeling?
Well, probably the major thing is not going all in, or doing a partial remodel and then sort of leaving something that really telegraphs that it wasn't totally remodeled. For example, like if you go into a bathroom and the bathtub is yellowed and stained mm-hmm. and they've left that in, but yet they've remodeled everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, saving a little money here and there is not really gonna help in the long run if the whole thing is brought down by leaving that one ugly thing in the room, you know?
That's a very good point. And then one of the things, I mean, for staging, I think is a different mindset because the timeline is very short.
Yes.
And so I never, if clients like, well, my kitchen's really outdated, I was always like, well, I don't think we have enough time. And also you won't get the return on investment for it in such a short period of time, in a couple months, basically.
Right.
And it's hard to draw that line. So do you encounter the same issue where the client just, you can start to see that they start going overboard with their remodeling? Do you have anything to help them to kind of pull back?
I find that most clients start small and grow. Mm-hmm. So it's really not necessarily, I mean, most of the time they realize that they think they don't want to spend much money, you know, going in. But as we get into the project and they see what they can have and how it can impact everything, they usually want to go further. Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of, you know, we're designing for them to live there primarily, you know, so they want to enjoy it. And once they get through with everything, they want to be happy and with their end result. So, Usually that means going further than they thought.
Mm. And what are some of the expectations or must know for homeowners when it comes to remodeling?
Well, typically budgets grow, and to kind of go in there thinking, you know, with a little bit of room in your budget. And also time frames are always longer than what you think. So don't plan a big party for the day that when your contractor says he'll be done. So, you know, back that off a little bit.
So in your experiences, like how much should a homeowner budget for a remodel? Or it just depends on project by project?
It depends on project by project, but it also depends on the area because there's just so many different variables in terms of labor cost and, you know, shipping costs of product and all that stuff. It really depends on, I mean, I know what it is for my area, but I don't know anywhere else. It's just completely different in every area. You know, everybody has sort of different circumstances with how they can remodel in certain areas, like for example, in San Francisco or New York. And there's just lots of different other variables that go into that kind of pricing.
I see. And then is there usually a time frame that they should pad in when it comes to delay as well? Like say if the project is going to take 3 months, maybe we need to like schedule it back 2 weeks or something like that. Or is it project by project as well?
It just depends on the scope of the work. I would say that if you're going to do a major gut remodel on a bathroom, and if you're not like changing of locations of plumbing fixtures, then that could be like 6 weeks to 2 months. That's like a master bath or something, you know, where the tile work takes time, you know, the plumbing takes time, everything takes days and sometimes a couple of weeks. So it just, you just want to allow plenty of time for that process to happen where people aren't pushed. Because when contractors get pushed, then mistakes happen and, you know, people end up working on top of each other and it's just never a good situation.
I see.
And also you just can't push contractors. I mean, they only move so fast and they're not going to move any faster unless you pay them big money.
Yeah. So yeah, that's totally understandable. Especially you want the work to be done right. And that's the other thing too.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any recommendation on hiring contractors, for example? Like I just interviewed a homeowner and one of the things that was difficult for them was to hire the right one. And they end up hiring someone where they did a great job in the beginning and then the performance dropped off. So yeah. What recommendation do you have for homeowners when it comes to situations like that?
Well, I've been through that situation myself many times. And as a designer, you know, I'm always recommending contractors to homeowners. Mm-hmm. And what I have come down to, I've just come down to where I use about three or four guys regularly. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that I know that these guys have been in business a long time, each of them. They have all honored their commitments to their homeowners. They are there if there's a problem. They will go back and fix things if something's wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's the most important thing you have to evaluate is that callback and that the fact that they've been in business a long time and that they have satisfied customers that they've worked for. Because it's you know, people will come in with a lower price. Other people will. And it's easy to get caught up with going with a lower price. But the most important thing is, will they come back? And right. Will they follow through? And will they be there in the end? And will they make things right? Because actually, I mean, all of them are going to make mistakes along the way. All mm-hmm. of them, you're going to have problems in every single job. And it's not really about how many problems you have. It's how you can fix them. Mm-hmm. And you know, being there when things get sticky and helping work things out.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
So that's why I've kind of come down to like three or four people that I know and work with and I'm comfortable with, and I can offer those to my clients, but I cannot go beyond that without having personal experience with people.
Yeah, I think that's a tricky thing. And I think that scares a lot of homeowners too. And I see that too with staging. I think especially in an industry where there's really not a clear regulation in terms of like what client can expect, it's always, it's hard. I mean, it's, you know, you can go buy tools like Yelp or House or I think there's Angie's List, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's really hard to say because you just don't know. And sometimes it just feels like a crapshoot almost.
I know. I think, you know, the good thing about like working with a designer is that they also have some, you know, pull with some of the contractors that they use. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the bad thing about being a homeowner, just calling a contractor out of the blue and having them do work is that that contractor knows that they're never going to see that homeowner again, probably, you know,
right.
Or it'll be a one-time project, or it may be, maybe they'll call them back for a master bath or something if they're calling for a kitchen or whatever, but it's not like it's ongoing work that's going to keep coming. So with a relationship, like if you're working with a designer, there's a relationship in place there, and that contractor doesn't want to disappoint the designer and make the designer look bad. So, you know, you're building in a little more confidence like that if you can, you know, if you can afford to, you know, have both professionals involved.
Right. No, I definitely agree with that. It's in a way, it's an insurance policy too, because people want to make sure they have good vendors, and contractors like, oh, you're a one-off client, where I have this client that sends me like 10 projects a year. So that's a little bit different.
Exactly. Right. And the same can go with like real estate agents and stagers like yourself, you know, anyone that you work with consistently that you can offer up as a contractor for someone, that's going to be a little bit more insurance for the homeowner, you know, than just calling someone out of the blue.
Yeah. And in your opinion, when it comes to remodeling, what are some of the items that will get the most return on investment?
Well, kitchens, of course, are always noted as high return.
Mm-hmm.
I liked flooring, because wood flooring is such a good investment, I think, in your home. And people are just really moving away from having a lot of carpeting in their homes now. And that's a big investment, you know, putting a wood floor in. But if you can put it in early on where you can enjoy it, and then it's already there when you sell the house, I think it's a big selling tool.
Okay. Yeah, no, I definitely agree, because I think they've done statistics like kitchen and bath are the most, that has the highest return on investment, especially when you resell
mm-hmm.
the home.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love that you brought up wood flooring as well, because I think that's one of the things too. I think people generally feel wood flooring also feels more expensive than carpets.
Yes, that's right.
And how about picking colors and finishes? Like, this is something I see homeowners get stuck on a lot, because they just feel overwhelmed because there's so many different, because, you know, like when we're picking wall colors, and then there's a trim, you know, there's like, you know, like molding and all that stuff. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I think it kind of depends on how much you want to paint
mm-hmm.
When it comes to paint colors. Like if you have all the finish in your house were probably chosen at one time and everything sort of works together. Well, sometimes if you want to change that tonality, like from beige to gray or gray to beige or whatever, then all of the stuff, the hard products that are in the house, like maybe tile or, you know, electrical outlets and switches, shutters, anything like that, is sort of geared to go with what's there. So if you want to, a lot of times, these days, we have a lot of clients who have kind of a creamy yellow look to all their paint colors and finishes. Like they may have travertine floors here in this area, and they have kind of a warm white, you know, base on everything. Well, they now want to go gray, so they want to go white moldings and all that. Well, when you change that, then you change the other stuff, all looks dirty next to it, you know?
Mm.
So the undertones are kind of a big thing. So if all you're going to change is wall finishes, wall color, then, you know, you just need to make sure that the wall color goes with the trim color that you have. If you're changing trim and walls, then, you know, you just have to make sure that the other finishes work with that color too. So it's kind of tricky. It just depends, like, for staging, you know, if you're just freshening up color, I would go with soft colors and not anything bright, and I'm sure you know all that kind of parameter for that.
Yeah, I know, like I like that you mentioned bright, because I think people automatically think, oh, then I just use white. And then a lot of issues I run into is that people use like a really white, like a stark white. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very difficult when it comes to staging, because then the room feels very cold and we have to bring a lot more things in to kind of feel, to make the room feel more warmed up.
Right.
So that's definitely something to take into consideration, just because that's why we always recommend some sort of off-white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like mm-hmm. a beige color, it would be fine. A cream would be fine. But something that's mm-hmm. really cold and white can make people feel like the hospital white, you know, or like the renter's white. You know, you don't, it doesn't inject or add anything into the room to make it feel warm and welcoming.
Yeah.
So that's the tricky part. Especially, right. That's something I see a lot of homeowners, the mistakes that they make too.
Mm-hmm.
Or they
mm-hmm.
pick very, very like creamy yellow, and then it yeah. becomes very hard sometimes too.
Yeah. Right.
So it sounds like the tones are tricky when it comes to picking the colors. Can you talk a little bit more about cold versus warm tones? And I love that you said something about, you know, like if you have warm white finishes on the items, try to go with a brighter white or cooler tones. So is it usually like a balance between cool and warm? Or is it like if I use warm tone here on the wall, I should just use warm tone on everything else?
Well, I think I've written a couple blog posts on how to combine cool and warm like that. Mm. I think sometimes you need to really make it purposeful if you're going to do it. Like if you have warm white trim and warm white, you know, tile or whatever in the kitchen or countertops or whatever, then I think you can go with a cooler tone, but it has to be significant. It not just sort of like a cooler white. It needs to be like a cool gray or a, you know, something that's a big difference. And even a dark gray is good. And it can cool things down, but yet not feel, just not feel all yellow in a room, you know? Mm-hmm. So, it's kind of a tricky combination, but you can combine it. I think there's a lot of fabrics out there now that combine gray and beige,
right.
And, mm-hmm. Kind of injecting some of that sometimes helps make that into a color scheme all on its own.
Mm-hmm.
So, you can, you know, then combine those effectively.
Cool. And I will probably ask you those blog posts. I can link it in the show notes as well.
Okay.
Yeah. And then who are some of your, or who and what are some of your biggest design inspirations?
Well, I have some designers that I follow and love their work. Victoria Hagen is an East Coast designer. She does amazing work. Nancy Braithwaite, beautiful, simple style, very powerful though. Her looks are just, you know, very powerful, but simple statements. And then Daryl Carter also has real neutral envelope with, a lot of wood and interesting high contrast type pieces. And I just love their style. I also love to look at the works of other designers that have different styles, which would be like Anthony Barada. I love his work because he just does everything completely in a space. Mm-hmm. And he just looks at all the details and everything is so done. And that's just amazing to see. When you're in this business and you do all this every day, it's just to see every single I dotted and T crossed in a room like that is just amazing.
Yeah,
so
it's hard to do.
I get inspiration from a lot of different styles like that.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. And then what are some of the big trends that you see coming up in 2016?
Well, I think that we will definitely see more people in remodeling incorporating like longevity into their spaces. So like planning for the future, like you talked about earlier. So, you know, showers and bathrooms that can accommodate, you know, walkers and wheelchairs and that kind of thing. I think that people will be planning ahead more. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that was kind of a trend and I am seeing it more and more, mm-hmm. Especially as baby boomers age, people are going to get more on board with all that. I mm-hmm. think also that people are really into remodeling now. And I think remodeling is just going to continue to take off. People are investing in their homes and really want to make their homes their personal spaces where they can come and relax and enjoy living there. And they're not afraid to spend money there and to invest in that remodel.
Yeah, I think that's interesting you say that. But thinking about it, I definitely see a new crop of like really popular bloggers that have like, they're very DIY. They're, you know, they basically remodel their home themselves, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Like Young House Love, for example, they have become very successful where they share their home remodel projects basically one by one. I think they used to write a blog every day. And
yeah,
now
they
have two books coming, or one already came out and a new one coming out, all about remodeling projects. So when it comes to those type of DIY homeowners, like, do you have any words of wisdom, for example? Because I'm sure you have seen some DIY remodel that had gone horribly wrong.
Yeah. Well, I think that the most important thing is trying to master the craft before you start the project, because you don't want to be, you know, trying to do a tile job and, you know, you have some nice tile that you really love and you want to use and you just end up with a mess, you know? So practice the craft a little bit before you do it yourself. And certainly there's a plethora of, how to, you know, DIY thing, information out there on how to do these projects. So, but it's much more than just follow it step by step. It's kind of like you have to practice a little bit. I mean, the reason why I like to hire professionals to do all this work is because it's, they really are fine. Their skills are finely tuned and they are so good at what they do. And so the finishes end up just looking so beautiful because they're perfect. You know, the paint jobs are really nice. The tile jobs are beautiful. And, you know, you just don't want to ruin your good product with a bad installation, you know?
Yeah. Especially materials can get expensive, you know?
Yes, very.
Yeah. So do you have any design pet peeves?
Well, one of them is islands, kitchen islands. I love kitchen islands, but I don't like when I come in and there's some weird shape to them. You know, they're angled on the end or they have different angles all the way around. A lot of times around here anyway, builders have built islands to sort of reflect the perimeter walls of the kitchen. So sometimes there's like a weird pie shape to the kitchen, and then they build a pie shape island. And to me, I think islands should really be more a little more generic in shape, and I want them to look logical and look like a piece of furniture in the room as opposed to sort of outlining the shape of the room.
That makes sense. I think builders out here are pretty square about it that way. I mean, I think I've only seen rectangle ones. I don't think I've ever seen like a pie shaped one.
No.
That sounds a little crazy.
It is crazy, but it happens.
Gosh. And then what are some of your go-to styling props or tricks when it comes to furnishing a room?
Well, I like, and it depends on the room. In kitchens, I love glass canisters.
And it looks great in your photos. I love them.
Yeah, I kind of use it in all the kitchen shots. And, you know, big bowls of fruit and things like that. I always have fresh flowers and or tree branches or something like that. Philodendron leaves. I love philodendron leaves. And they're nice and architectural looking and take up a lot of space. And they're dramatic and they're not expensive. White dishes, I like that. White plates, things like that. And then for, you know, other rooms of the house and bathrooms, I like sponges and different white towels, white products in the bathroom, I think look fresh and clean. I use soaps, you know, little soaps in a in a dish and bowl, things like that. And then for other styling and accessorizing, I like big items that kind of take up space and look sort of structural and architectural. You know,
That's okay.
Big vases and also some products that are, you know, I go to Round Top, which is a local antique fair.
That's on my bucket list.
Yeah, there's lots of stuff out there. And it's nice to find some rustic pieces, you know, and and items that are sort of unusual that would go in a home. It sort of creates interest and, you know, brings some texture into the space.
Yeah, I want to ask you about grouping, actually, because I feel like every time I try to explain to the homeowner, it seems very abstract, but it's such an effective tool when it comes to styling. Like, among your homepage of your website, I love you have this grouping of vases on the shelves. You have this other triangular grouping on the other side with these three vases, tall, medium, and low. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Is that on the homepage, the first page?
Yeah. I also love the way you do your throw. That looks so comfortable and inviting. Oh,
good. Well, we just wanted to add some texture in there because those were big white chairs.
Yeah. And it looked great.
Yeah. So, groupings, I do like odd numbers, you know, and so threes and fives are good. Usually I like threes just, you know, and high, low, kind of vary things like that. I'm not that big on pairs of things unless it's some very symmetrical type arrangement. For mantles and things like that, I like to do, you know, sort of a higher arrangement on one side and then something lower on the other. But I do like to kind of mix things up and, you know, create interest with variation of shapes and sizes and textures. And also, I think it's important to, you know, look at the contrast and whether things are dark or light, because you can put a bunch of light objects up there and they'll just disappear into a light wall. So contrast is real important.
Yeah. What I really love about this photo on your homepage is that there's a huge TV on the fireplace. But when you first see it, that's, you don't notice that at all. It, like, it really blends seamlessly into the surrounding of it. And I also love your furniture grouping, because I think a lot of times furniture placement can be kind of formulaic. I mean, it's kind of, I mean, when you buy interior design books, they show you like diagrams and stuff. And usually it's like, you know, sofa on each side or accent chair on the other side and then a coffee table in the middle. But I love that here you have the ottoman and the coffee table, but it feels very natural. It's like a very nice flow. It doesn't make the room feel too sparse. I think if you only use one or the other, it's going to make it look a little bit lonely.
Yeah.
But I love the way that you had arranged these furniture. I think it looks great.
Well, that particular job was a remodel that we, where we took down the wall between the living room and the kitchen. And it wasn't a very wide wall. It was about 8 feet wide, but that enabled us to have that, that seating group kind of on the opposite side. That room is actually quite long and narrow. And by opening that up, we, you know, were able to use more width there. So, and also because it was so long and narrow, really it kind of needed the ottomans to fill out that length of that space. And I really liked the chairs. For one, that one chair is really great for TV viewing, you know, and it rotates there too a little bit. So they can move that chair around. But, and then the sofa is good because they can lie on the sofa and watch the TV. But the TV was a key thing because they wanted to be able to see the TV from the kitchen. And they couldn't before because the wall was there. So now that we've got the TV up there and then you can see the TV from the kitchen and, you know, the whole seating group, everything kind of works. And I think because we tiled that whole fireplace wall, that TV doesn't seem quite the monster that it is. You know?
I think so. It's the corresponding shape of it. And I think it's very well done. And it's kind of funny when you have this conversation, it's like TV is such a big part of our lives those days.
And it's kind of, you know, it is and it's always going to be there. And that's always going to be the way it is. So we have to kind of deal with it and accept it and not try to hide it all the time, you know, and just, you know, for one thing, it had to be functional for the people living in this space. And now it really is. And the fact that the TV is there is just sort of ancillary to me. It's not the critical thing. Yeah. It doesn't stand out so much.
That's awesome. I love that. Because I sometimes feel like it's the bane of designers' existence. Because I think they make TV more pretty. they make TV prettier now too. I mean, it used to be like this huge thing that takes up a giant, you know, prime real estate in your living room. But now with flat screen TV, they can really be accessorized rather than this giant distraction.
Right. And it's so much better with flat screens. Mm-hmm. And that that particular job, I mean, they actually started out with a smaller TV and they got one. They got the bigger model after the remodel was over. So it was like, oh, hello, the TV's there, you know. But everybody has that TV and we're all looking at, you know, how to mount them above fireplaces now. Yeah. I mean, in terms of layout, it's really a good layout to have a TV mounted above a fireplace because the fireplace is usually the focal point of the room and the TV is also the focal point of the room. So instead of fighting that and having them in two different locations, you know, and having to work seating arrangements around that, it's better to just have it all in one place.
Yeah, no, I agree. It just makes it so much easier.
Yeah.
And then where can our audience find you?
Well, I have a blog that I write, and then I'm on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, all those social media outlets.
Yeah, that's how I found you actually, through your blog. I think I was researching about colors for another show, and I ran across your blog, and I saw your portfolio photo. I was like, this looks great. We should have her on the show.
Oh, thanks. Mm-hmm.
And then do you have any special project coming up that you want to talk briefly about? I think you mentioned something that you have a course coming out.
Well, it's just I'm actually in the process of sort of writing a second blog. Mm. And I'm developing some content for that. And it's more geared toward designers and sort of how to do this business, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not offering myself up as the pro at that, but I'm just sharing my own experiences and I'm hoping to have other people sort of share those theirs as well. So it's a complex business and it's difficult to, you know, be successful. And so I think all the support that we can give each other, the better. And so that's one thing I'm working on now. And I'm also considering, starting to write up some guidelines for remodeling for end users and things that, you know, I run into every day when I'm on jobs and when I'm working with clients and working with contractors that we take into account and we do automatically without thinking that homeowners don't necessarily think of. So trying to, you know, have work on some kind of guide like that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great idea because I think for most laymen, when they come in contact stuff like that, they really don't know where to start approaching yet. Mm-hmm. I was like that before I got into staging, you know, like I think it does take continuously exposure as a professional to be able to know like what are some of the traps to avoid versus right. like a homeowner who maybe read a blog or like watched HGTV program. That's not enough to know like the everyday nuances that goes in our professional lives.
Right. Yeah. And now it's, you know, the bad thing about so much information that's out there, it's not really sometimes about the content as it is about the marketing of that content. So you may have gotten that content and seen it on Google because it's been publicized very well, but it may not have the meat, you know, it may not have the real issues that you need to deal with. So I think it's important to sort of look at the source and to see who's, you know, where is that information coming from and what experience do they have and that kind of thing.
I agree. And I always ask a parting question. What is the one tip you'll give to homeowners who are, maybe they're going to stage their house themselves or style and decorate their home?
Mm-hmm. I think to sort of step back and really look at the whole, you know, I think that oftentimes so many people get caught up in the little details and get focused on little things that aren't really that important in the overall scheme of things. So to sort of step back and really make a list of what are the most important things to do here, or what is my end goal, what do I want it to look like, and what are the big things I can do to achieve that? And those are the things you want to tackle first, and those are the things you want to work on the most.
That's a great suggestion. I love that. And before we end the show, do you have any other things that you want to share, or do you have any questions?
No, I was just wanting to ask you a little bit about the home staging business and how you saw that coming and growing and in the future. How are you?
Oh, I like that. You're the first guest that asked like interview question. I think that the industry is very young. I think there has been a lot of changes and progression in the last 10 years I've been in business.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they're going toward a positive way in the sense that we are getting definitely more media attention with shows like, you know, HGTV was already there, but yeah. with shows like, you know, Million Dollar Listings on Bravo,
right.
you know, or other type of similar show, people are starting to see home staging as a benefit, not something that seems like it just a way to get more money out of the seller kind of a thing. Because mm-hmm. it does really change the way we see the home. I mean, ultimately it's part of marketing process. In my personal opinion, you are changing the way you're presenting your product. You're making it look like, you know, and showcase it to make sure that it looks amazing and the buyers will want to buy it, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I also have worked in visual merchandising, working for big companies like Saks and Ralph Lauren. And visual merchandising is a huge part of selling products. It's because,
right.
and also having worked on commercial photo shoots as well, it's that you're basically showcasing the product in its best light. So any mm-hmm. product, of course, will have flaws, just like humans, right? We
mm-hmm.
all have positive attributes about us and also flaws. But mm-hmm. the way home staging is not necessarily hiding the flaws, but it's actually accentuating the positive attributes of a home. Like you mentioned earlier on the show, for example, the architecture details. I work in San Francisco Bay Area. We have a lot of older Victorian homes. Obviously, people don't want the Victoria interior, but they appreciate the architecture details that left behind, you know, like the picture rails or the crown moldings. In some homes, they still have stained, you know, the windows and stuff, the stained glass windows.
Mm-hmm.
They retain those part of their homes because they find that it not only adds a deeper layer and visual interest to their home, they also appreciate those details. So
uh-huh.
home staging helps you to kind of accentuate those positive attributes in the home. So I think that is important.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it's great that you are coming out with a course for other designers to help them progress in a better way in the industry. Because we're actually considering doing the same thing with the home staging industry, because I just feel like a lot of times, this is not to say bad things about training schools, but I feel like mm-hmm. a lot of times new stagers come out, they don't realize there's actually a huge, you know, as you know, as a business owner, right? Like
mm-hmm.
there's actually... when you first got out of school versus when you're a successful business owner, there's actually a huge gap in between.
Right, a big learning curve.
Yeah, a big learning curve. And mm-hmm. some people's learning curves are harder than others. I've known stagers who have been able to hit six figure very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And I've known stagers who took a long time, like me personally, a while to get to my six figure or my definition mm-hmm. of success.
Right.
And there are a lot, and then a lot of stagers, that's the thing too, with we're seeing there's a very hot activities on the market right now. So we're going to see a new kind of a whole new batch of home stagers coming out on the market because they feel like, oh, it looks like something I can make money very quickly.
Right.
But as every business owner know that it's actually very different, right? Like
yes.
what it looks like. Our job looks very glamorous. You know,
it is not glamorous.
It is not, right? Like
no.
there are many, many hours behind closed door where we sweat blood, even cry about
I
our
know,
work.
I know.
That most people don't see on a TV show like HGTV or Million Dollar Listing. And we
mm-hmm.
see a lot of these stagers are kind of like flash in a pan. They may try to get the business by undercutting experienced stagers, which I understand why they're doing it. But at the same time, it's like, well, they're not hurting my status, but, you know, they still hurt in a bit because they're undercutting. So they're not only hurting their business profits, right? They might not mm-hmm. actually. And a lot of times I find a lot of stagers, they don't understand how profits work.
Right.
I was in a business competition a few years ago. They're called Make My $1 Million Business. And there's a lot of emphasis on I really love the organization because they really focus on helping women to achieve economic independence, which I think is very important. Mm-hmm. I think women has come a long way. I've heard stories about, I remember when I won my category for that business competition. This is like a business competition. You write in like business plan and then like, you know, you send in your financial and all that. They see the potential. Mm-hmm. I remember the governor of New Mexico was there because the award ceremony was in New Mexico. And she said that when she first started her business, she actually had to have her husband co-signing a loan because mm-hmm. back then, bank won't grant loans to women mm-hmm. at all. Like you have to have a man to co-sign on your loan, which now it's like completely ridiculous, right? Mm-hmm. And clearly she was successful because now she's a governor or at the time. Yeah. So I think we have come a long way, but I think there's a lot of education that needs to happen between, you know, these two points of your business journey. And so that's actually yeah. something we're considering doing as well and coming out with maybe like a course or a book to kind of share my personal experience, how we built our business the way it is today. Mm-hmm. I also think there's a lot of misconception in general about how to run a business. And, you know, when we get to that coveted six figure, actually it didn't fix anything. Like yeah. if anything, it brought out more issues in a lot of ways because when yeah. you grow, your issues grow as well. And so I do see the industry is growing toward a positive space, but I also see there's a lot of kind of undercurrent that are a little bit more dangerous. And for the consumer too, in a way is consumer protection. Like I really think it's important to have a very ethical business practice. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, when you're not undercutting the competition or do anything shady, right? Because I feel like there's right. enough work out there for everyone.
Yes.
But ethical in the sense where you are a responsible business person, that you're not screwing your consumer in the process. Because mm-hmm. like we talk about it too, you know, like the distrust between us and contractors, for example, is because mm-hmm. more likely or not than not, most of the time we have been burned by a contractor who like showed up, did a great job, but then the performance dropped midway through the project or we never heard from again.
Yeah.
So there's like a huge distrust between the consumers and the professionals. And that's something really hard because once we lost that trust, it's really hard to win that back as an industry.
Right.
So yeah.
That's yeah. true. And there's a huge distrust. They've made, you know, television shows on HGTV about that. So it's really... you know, with contractors. So it's a big, I think it's important to sort of share, the information that you have as an experienced, professional with, other people in the industry, because it helps them and it helps your industry in general.
Yeah. And it makes things down the line easier too. It's because if I can help people more along in their business and they're not screwing over their customers while building a really successful business, then in the long run it's good for everybody because then we become a more legitimate industry. And I think
right.
I don't know how it is in interior design, but I assume it's also a woman, predominantly woman industry. And a lot of people feel like, oh, I mean, like I have my husband providing the income. And I'm more like a hobby stager or whatnot, whatever. That's something we see often in our industry as well. It's hard yeah. for us to become legitimized when people are like, oh, you're just a woman and you're not running a proper business.
Right.
We just did a retreat. It's our second year doing it for like advanced stagers to kind of come together and then just talk about issues in our business in general. And that actually came up was one mm-hmm. of the things too. It's that like... I think also as a woman and as a business owner, a lot of times when we are making objections about our business, it can come across like whiny and then or people don't take us seriously as professionals and undermine our expertise. So that's something that we're working against in a way as well.
Yes. Well, that interior designers have had that issue for forever. And, it definitely goes on all the time. And there have been a lot of very successful designers come out of, you know, that kind of situation where they just started as a hobby. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that they're not talented. It's just that there's a difference between someone who is, you know, has overhead and has people that are they're responsible for paying, and you know, someone who's working out of their home part time as kind of a hobby. So there's a big difference in that, and a lot of times people don't see that when you come, you know, and you present to your, you know, your fees and how much things cost.
Yeah.
And you know, it's kind of a it's just the way things are, and it's the way they're all, they'll always be, unfortunately. But the more education and information we can all share, I think the better.
Yeah. And that's not to knock someone who's coming out and then doing part-time or anything like
right.
that. That's not my intention saying things like this.
Yeah.
And because we all started somewhere. I mean, I started part-time too. And so, and you can still build a very successful business. And in a way too, like when you said that, it reminds me of Kelly Restler, is that
her name?
I mean, her husband was very wealthy, and she had quite a reputation as a socialite before she became a very successful interior designer. I mean, her work is gorgeous. In some way, it's also harder for those type of people, because I think in a way we had to prove harder that we are worth, you know, our money. You know, like what we justify in our work and stuff like that. So, So in general, I think it's growing. It's going in a positive way, especially in bigger markets, obviously like San Francisco or New York. People definitely know to stage. But in smaller markets too, now people are starting to have more and more awareness about home staging and the importance of it. So I think that's a really good thing.
Yes, I do too.
Yeah. So thank you again today for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, you were great. I just love everything that you have said, especially about mixing colors and stuff. And like, you know, we talk about undertones and stuff, as well as, you know, your design pet peeves. I love that you mentioned about the oddly shaped kitchen islands.
Yeah, and I've written a blog post about that too.
Yeah, like with contractors, we have seen that with, you know, with real estate as well. Like a lot of contractors, they want to get more square footage on the paper, so they're built. Mm-hmm. Rooms are like oddly shaped. You know, it's no longer a rectangle, it might go out, you know, this way slightly, just because so they can say, oh, there's 5 more square feet on the deed. So we have definitely run into that as well. So that's it for today's show, and I hope you had enjoyed it. Carla is a wealth of information. If you want to find out more about her or her work on remodeling and design, please definitely visit her blog. I'm just so very impressed by what she had to say today on the show, and also the quality of her blog post. She was very thoughtful about design and with her clients, and I was very, very impressed by that. So thank you so much again for listening. If you enjoyed today's show, please leave us a review and a rating on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher. It'll only take you 1 minute to do so, but this will help us keep the show going. As usual, feel free to ask any questions on the show notes or our private Facebook group. You can find the show notes by going to www.stagemore.com/podcast. And that's it. Have a fantastic week and happy staging.